You're listening to The Osiris Munir Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
What's up, my looms, my luminaries? Hey, baby kins out there, what's going on? It's a busy, busy week as usual. Lots of stress and turmoil on the top of the planet at the bottom. You know, there's a lot going on. Heat rising, making some places cold, some hot, some just a, you know, whole big temperamental thing we have. I like when mama wants to spread her wings, she just gets up and goes, look, let me take a yawn real quick and the winds blow and things go out. But anyway, hey, out there, before we get started, let's give a shout out to our sponsor, Kevin Pike, Coldwell Banker. He's a senior real estate and probate specialist, 818-571-1508. He will take care of all of your needs. So go see him, please. Shout out to all of those out there who choose love over chaos. Today, I have a wonderful surprise. He's been on here before, but I can't get enough of him. So you have to endure my pleasure, okay? He's an Emmy Award winner, author, histographer, I'd like to say, performer, Grammy-nominated writer, Sir Jeffrey Mark. He is going to talk to us today. He's done all kinds of stuff, you guys. I'm serious. He's been on Broadway. He's best known for his book on Lucille Ball, also Ella Fitzgerald and Ethel Merman. If you will give me a big shout out there from wherever you are for our guest today, Sir Jeffrey Mark.
Lady Osiris.
Hey, Jeffrey.
Hello, my friend. How are you? Good to see you.
I'm fine.
Good to
be seeing you. Now, look, you guys, I'm going to show you how fine minds work now. I didn't know what color I was going to collig Jeffrey's name in, and it was green that came up. It started out a whole nother color, and I changed it to green, and it came out like that kind of line. And look at what Jeffrey's wearing. Something with that green. Isn't that something? I love when that works like that. Hey, Jeffrey.
Synchronicity is awesome.
Oh, it's wonderful. A wonderful thing. So, Jeffrey.
Yes, ma'am.
From the author of the Lucy book and currently promoting your biography of Ella Fitzgerald, what is one of the lost stories that nobody told? You didn't have time to write it in the book. You didn't want to tell anybody, but it's years and years later and you can safely talk about it. What is one of those stories about Ella or Lucy or anybody? But basically, Ella, I want to hear her stories, because before you speak, you guys, I want Jeffrey to let you know, for those of you who don't know this legendary person, what she came from as an African-American woman. She, you know, went through drugs, the streets. I want Jeffrey to tell you about her and before he talks about the book and her legacy. Go, Jeffrey.
Sure. That was 17 questions. I'll pick one. Well, I don't know that I have an untold Ella story. But I think for those of you who perhaps haven't read the two books I've written about Ella, one of the things I couldn't talk about, so this kind of sort of works. The first book was written while Ella was alive. I was asked by her people to not touch certain subjects. So I didn't lie. I just didn't go into them. The second book was written after Ella passed. And, you know, with family and her foundation approval, I told the full truth. And one of those truths is that when Ella's mother passed away, and Ella was sent to live with her aunt because her stepfather was sexually abusing her, the trauma there, Ella didn't want to live with her aunt either. And Ella ran away and was picked up by the police and was sent to a reformatory for girls. Except at this reformatory, there was one set of living situations for white girls and one set of living situations for African-American girls. Ella was systematically tortured and raped almost every single day. Mm-hmm. Only because she was African-American.
For no other reason.
And Ella ran away again. She actually broke free of that place and went to Harlem to get lost, where she couldn't be found.
Mm-hmm.
At that moment, Harlem was a kind of a divided area. It's where very, very wealthy African-Americans lived in beautiful homes, and it's where mm-hmm. poverty-stricken African-Americans lived. And Ella was taken in to a house of prostitution. Now, she was not one of the girls having sex with men for money. She was young. She was a teenager. She was the lookout. She was the cover-up. If she saw someone coming who she thought could be an undercover cop or real police, it was her job just to be at the window, leaning on the windowsill, looking. And then she would let them know, and out would come knitting. And if they got raided, all you have were women sitting knitting together. This is a knitting circle. We don't know what you're talking about.
Hmm.
Ella also ran numbers for extra money. If you know what that is, before legal gambling of any kind in New York City or anywhere else in this country other than Las Vegas, numbers running was you bet on a number to come up. And if your number comes up, you get the money. And if your number doesn't come up, you've lost the money. Ella did that. The drugs were never part of her life. That part was Billie Holiday, not Ella Fitzgerald. Mm-hmm. But Ella wanted to be a dancer. She wanted to call herself Snake Hips Fitzgerald and dance. And the ladies of the house put her name in for an amateur night. And they called Ella at the house of prostitution and said, "This is your night. Come on in." And she freaked. And the girls pushed her out the door, literally, took her to the amateur night. The last act on the bill was a sister act called the Edwards Sisters, and an African-American vaudeville. They were very big stars. Mm. They were called a flash act. Just mm-hmm. one thing, boom, boom, bom, 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 contorting their bodies, dancing, tapping all over the place. They were an amazing. That's why they were the closing act.
Mm-hmm.
Then comes the amateur hour. And Ella said, "I can't follow those girls and dance. Are you kidding?" And they called her name, and the ladies from the house pushed her on stage.
Mm.
Spotlight hit her. And I'm not certain who was happier, Ella in the spotlight or the spotlight to get Ella.
No. Because it was
instant magic. And the band leader, who was the MC of the evening, calls her over and says, "Honey, you got to do something. You won't dance. Can you sing something?" She said, "Yeah, I could sing something. What do you know?" And there was a Hoagie Carmichael song called Judy that she'd heard somebody else perform. And they, "Oh, we've got that arrangement." Because often bands back then would have the arrangement mm-hmm. of a popular song to mm-hmm. copy it. And Ella sang the song and Ella won.
Wow.
And
wowed the audience.
She never stopped winning.
Hmm.
So that's a story that unless you've read my book, you wouldn't know about.
You wouldn't know it. Now you've done, take us back on your timeline. Your timeline.
I was born in 1492. What do you want to know, dear?
Were you born on the Titanic by chance? No, I'm just kidding. When did you meet Lucille Ball, Ethel Merman, and Ella on the same timeline? Or was there a gap between when you met them?
The one I met first to actually speak to was Ethel Merman.
Okay.
I saw Lucille Ball at the 1964 mm-hmm. World's Fair in New York. They had a Lucy Day. So I was there and I could, you know, there's tens of thousands of people wanting to see her. I saw her from very much afar. But to actually talk to someone, the first one was Ethel Merman. I met Miss Merman, oh golly, 1970. She was appearing in Hello, Dolly on Broadway. And my folks wouldn't take me to see her. They were taking me to see Fiddler on the Roof for about the seventh time. And I just broke ranks with them and ran to the St. James Theater where she was appearing. There was nobody at the stage door. I waited. And out comes Ethel Merman.
Wow.
And I told her how much I loved her work. And I walked her to her limousine. And I opened the door for her. And I got a, thanks, kid. And I noticed how tired she looked. And how her dark brown hair, when you're in spotlights for 2.5, 3 hours mm-hmm. every night, your hair bleaches out. Broadway mm-hmm. performers who have lighter hair, mm-hmm. you become a blonde. So her mm-hmm. hair was much lighter than I'd seen it on television. Mm-hmm. That was the first meeting. So that's 1970. I didn't get to talk to Ella till 1978. And it's funny you asked that question. I've been telling a story for quite a while that no one believes, and now I have proof. We'll talk about how I came to know about Ella and her music mm-hmm. in a different story. But mm-hmm. I went to see Ella at Carnegie Hall in 1978, standing room only, and I was in standing room, and she did her concert. There was a moment where, like, she was taking bows, but there was no music playing, and I shouted for her to sing Mac the Knife.
Mm-hmm.
And she was, you want to hear that, darling? Okay, just for you. And she sang Mac the Knife just for me. And then I was even bolder. And when the applause died down, now sing How High the Moon. She started to laugh. And she goes, all right, just for you. And people thought I was making this up. Somebody got a recording. Someone recorded that evening in their little in their lap. Uh-huh. And sent me the thing, and you can hear my voice asking for the songs. So I now have proof this actually happened. That's the first interaction. Lucille Ball interaction was in 1984 or 85 when she came to the Paley, what's now called the Paley Center in New York, which is a depository of old television kinescopes and videotapes and things. Started by Bill Paley of CBS, and she was doing a symposium, questions and answers. And I'm there, you know, I was one of the founding members of this place. That's how I was able to get the ticket. And people are asking her these inane questions, like, who did you like best, Mrs. Trumbull or the grocery? You know, like, you're here to learn from her, and this is what you want to know. And she was getting a little fed up. The microphone came to me. And she said, all right, the guy back there with the red beard, Gary Morton was her husband. And he was sitting on the edge of the stage. And he said, Lucy, there's nobody red. There's no redhead with a beard in there. There's no one there. She said, yes, yes, I could see him. And I had the mic. And I said, well, there's not much left on top, but I do have a red beard. And Lucy laughed at me. She laughed at me. And every hair on my body stood up. I made her laugh.
Her laugh.
The question I asked her was, I said, your good friend Jack Benny, and that got her attention. Your good friend Jack Benny said, the reason people tune into sitcoms, especially classic sitcoms, is because the stars have shtick they do. They don't do the same shtick every week, but there's usually 5 or 6 things that are rotated. And they tune in to see, which one are we going to get this week? I said to her, you gave up 2 pieces of shtick that you stopped doing. One was the crying Jack, you know, wah! And the other one was a noise she made when she was pulled up short or in a jam. She would go, ugh.
I've seen her do that.
Okay. That comes from her radio show before I Love Lucy, where she was doing commercials at the end for General Foods. And she each week she played a different historical or fictional character selling the product. And she was playing Miss Muffet, sitting on her tuffet, eating her Jell-O pudding. And along came a spider, and she just extemporized. Ugh. The writers loved it because it got a big laugh. So they put it into the scripts in big black letters, spider. So she'd know to make that noise at that moment.
Uh-huh. Oh, wow.
So I said to her, you gave up the spider. And she was very surprised that I knew what the spider was. And she said, young man, that is the most intelligent question anyone's ever asked me about my work. And for 25 minutes or so, she answered question after question to me. And finally, they were like pulling at her. You need to go on. There are other people here besides this guy. Yeah. And she said that I've got to take other questions, but you should write a book is what she said. Now, sitting next to me was a buddy of mine who had learned shorthand in the Navy. He was writing down every word she said, which is the beginning of the Lucy book.
Oh, wow. And
I've still got the microphone in my hand. She says, you're still standing. Why? Oh, okay. Just for you. Ooh, sit down.
Whoa.
So she made the spider just for me. This just for me stuff, I know it's corny, it's fanboy. It's not professional. But these meetings and these just for you things inspired me to move forward professionally. So that's how I met Ethel Merman, Lucille Ball, and Ella Fitzgerald. Ella, of course, I worked with towards the end of her career. I'm Grammy nominated because of Ella. I've written 2 books. The Ella Fitzgerald Foundation uses my book as their source material. The family approves of it. I'm a lucky guy. I'm a very, very, very lucky. And I'm a comedian. I'm a singer and I'm an actor. And
you're creative.
And I have my own shows too.
And you have your own shows. And the thing, Jeffrey, that I have not heard you say is that you were in alignment with success. You were, oftentimes the people that are shunned the most, black sheep, I'm one of them.
As am I.
Yeah. Those are the people that have the mission. I'm sure no one would have suspected, even yourself, that you were going to write these books, become a Broadway star,
But look, to be fair, because we got to tell the truth here.
What?
It's a funny thing. A childhood friend of mine ended up being the youngest CEO of a Fortune 500 company in the business world. He is very famous. Barry Feld. Hi, Barry. We grew up together. We were talking yesterday. Who could have known these two little Jewish boys would have ended up famous, both of us famous, he in his venue, me and mine. But I knew since I was 2 years old that show business was going to be it for me. I always knew. And
you did.
I did. Oh,
you knew.
Monday nights on CBS, back when the dinosaurs roamed the world, the lineup was, to tell the truth, I've Got a Secret, 2 celebrity panel shows, and Lucy. And we would only, as a family, watch those shows. Otherwise, we watched different things. But my grandparents, my great-grandmother, my parents, and I would sit every Monday night together and watch. My grandmother and great-grandmother knew where I was going at 2. My great-grandmother in Yiddish would sit me on her lap. You must go to school. You must learn to write really, really well. Important people are going to read what you're going to write. You must learn to write well. My grandmother was grooming me to be able to go to a fancy restaurant and not embarrass myself in front of famous people. And she used Kitty Carlisle, who was one of the panelists from To Tell the Truth, as an example of, be like her. Look how she does things. Oh, that guy just insulted her. Look how she laughed it off. Oh, that guy, she told that guy, no, stop. But in a very polite way. And my mother and grandmother one evening got into an argument. Mommy, she said, what does he need with Kitty Carlisle? He's 3 years old. And my grandmother said, you don't even know what's in your son. These are the people he's going to be dealing with when he grows up. And they fought. And my grandmother, in anger, said to her, you're a fool. One day, Jeff is going to be in Kitty Carlisle's living room telling her the story of tonight and laughing at you.
Wow.
About 40-some years later, I was in Kitty Carlisle's living room.
Mm.
My grandmother had passed, Mrs. Hart. I called her Mrs. Hart, not Kitty Carlisle. Mrs. Hart was in her 90s. I told her the story and we cried. And I was there because she invited me, because my Ethel Merman book had come out. Would you bring your wonderful book to my house and sign a copy and visit with me? I was in New York. I was staying in a hotel suite, publicizing the book. I don't know that I didn't open the window and just fly to her apartment, which was just off Fifth Avenue. Mm-hmm. And she lived in one of those buildings where the elevator opens in your apartment. Mm-hmm. And she let me come and watch her in her 90s take a singing lesson because she was still performing. And then visit with her socially and give her the book. And I told her the story. And, you know, if I didn't accomplish anything else in my career, that was pretty satisfying to make my grandmother's vision come true, except I had nothing to do with it. I didn't contact her. She contacted
me. You.
Mm-hmm. So synchronicity is a big part of my story.
We were talking about that. And to be honest with you, I don't find things like that. You know, people say somebody's lucky. No, you're not. You were in alignment and you something in you pushed you and drove you to lead you where you needed to be. You know, to me, lucky is like if you win a card game and you just happen to pick the right numbers or you may have some skills at cards. But fortune and being in alignment is quite different because you could have chosen to do a million other things. You could have been chosen to be a jailbird, be on drugs, be murdered. You know, there's millions of things of choices that we could have made, but something in you, along with what your grandmother saw, led you in the direction that you were supposed to go, which is why we're sitting here talking.
Well,
right now.
I mean, several things happened. One was being a child. We've talked about this before.
Yeah, but I want to talk about it again.
Yeah, my grandparents were wonderful. My parents, not wonderful. I was sexually abused. I was tortured. I was emotionally abused. And they used to sit around the kitchen table drinking coffee, eating, constantly eating, talking about living. Remember when? Remember back? Remember? They were only in their middle 20s. They didn't do anything. My father went to work when he had a job. My mother took care of the house, but they didn't. There were no hobbies. There were precious few friends. Their social life was the family in the house, sitting around, eating. And as a little boy, I said to myself, what's wrong with these people? I don't want to talk about living. I want to live. That was also my own seed planted. I don't want to end up like this. Mm-hmm. When I was 15 and a half, I was thrown out of the house for being gay. So since no one was supporting me, it was up to me to do everything. I was on my own. I was sent away for some schooling. But I was sent away to find out that I was going to court because against my will, I was being emancipated. So at 15 and a half, my parents divorced me. They were no longer morally, legally, or financially responsible for me.
How did you get that to happen? And you were a young person.
I didn't get it to happen. She made it happen. My mother.
Oh, your mom?
Yeah, they divorced me. I didn't divorce them.
So they literally signed you over to something else.
I became a ward of the court.
Oh, baby. I'm so sorry to hear that.
But not sent to live with anybody. A ward of the court on my own. I was now officially, the court made me an adult.
As a minor, they made you an adult?
Yeah.
How can they do, how did they do that?
You know, I don't to this day know all the machinations. I'm just telling you that it happened. That I had to go to court into a judge's chambers, sign papers, and was told specifically, this is it. You're on your own, kid. Good luck. Mm. But, you know, the next year I made my first film. 2 years later, I was in my first off-Broadway musical. 3 years later, I was working at the Playboy Club. So, yes, I could have been a statistic. But I didn't want to be a statistic. I wanted to be in show business. I wanted to make people laugh. I wanted to sing. I wanted to make people happy. I wanted to help. And you also know that I also had a drug and alcohol problem in my 20s and gave up show business for a while there because I couldn't be counted on. I was unreliable to them or to me. At 30, I got clean and sober. I just celebrated 37 years, which tells you how old I am.
Yeah.
37 years of sobriety.
Proud of you.
And, you know, all this stuff that has happened, we've talked about these some of these things before. I met my soulmate at 13. He was the reason I was thrown out of the house. How lucky to meet him at 13, how unlucky to get thrown out, except being thrown out freed me from the abuse and control so that I could take control of my own life and be Jeff. Be true to being Jeff. The way I dress.
I love that. You remind me of Elton John.
Just because. Just yeah. Because I was performing in Los Angeles and wonderful. May he rest in peace. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Rip Taylor came to see me.
I've heard of Rip Taylor.
Rip was an over-the-top comedian who used to throw confetti all over his audience while he worked. Rip said, let's go to dinner. I want to talk to you. And I will clean this up because I know we can't use bad language on LA Talk Radio.
You can use bad language.
Okay.
I mean, if you're using bad language as a reference to your storytelling, then that's what you're...
I'm repeating what somebody else said.
No, you're fine.
We ordered our food and Rip like grabbed my hand and said, Jeffrey, you are magic on stage. But you're dressed like a fucking accountant. I wore three-piece suits.
Ooh.
Conservative. He said, that's not you. Who told you to dress like that? I said, well, my mother. He said, well, never mind what he said. It wasn't a very nice thing he said about my mother, and that's okay. He said, be you. Your personality is large. You need to dress to your personality to brand you in show business. And he sent me shopping. Changed my life, changed my career, instantly changed it. I mean, the first.
Did he pay for you to go to?
Did he pay? No, he didn't pay anything.
So he just said he told you where to go and what to buy? Or okay.
No, he sent me to a store. There was a restaurant in West Hollywood back then. It's long ago closed, called the French Market. And inside this place was like a New Orleans style restaurant where little boutique shops all around the perimeter of where you ate.
Mm-hmm.
And he sent me to the shop, which had what I would call hooker wear, you know, stiletto heels and see-through blouses and itsy bitsy mini skirts. But they had a hat there, not sequin, but little mirrors. I still have it in my closet. And I said, oh, you know, I could wear that on stage and get a laugh. That's as far as my mind went with it. And how much is that? Oh, it's $50. I said, yeah, for $50, keep the hat. I came back to that restaurant that evening to have dinner because the next day I was leaving on my first cruise as an entertainer and I was nervous. I'd never done a cruise. I'd never even been on a cruise before. And the guy who's that store with the $50 was closing up shop and I was sitting right by the door of the shop. He walks over to me, puts the hat on my head, gets in my face like this. You need this. $5. And the New Yorker in me was like, why are you in my personal space? $5? 7 hours ago, it was $50. And then I heard, you need this. Okay. Give him the $5. Went on the cruise. Had a rehearsal. And at rehearsal, I told the lighting guy, When the cruise director introduces me, black out all the lights. I don't want any ambient light. Hit me with a spotlight from about here to about here. And just follow me. Because I used to pace the stage when I worked. I've gotten older. I don't pace quite as much as I used to. They introduce you. And, of course, they're thrilled to have you because you're in the middle of the ocean. We were going to Europe. No, we were going to Hawaii. You're in the middle of the ocean. It's you or nothing. They want you to be good. And then the laughter started. And I mean this huge laugh. It was the right audience on the right night with the right amount of liquor in them. And they are laughing and laughing. And I know why they're laughing. I play innocent. I said, well, I haven't done anything yet. Why are you all laughing? And they can, that makes them laugh more. And I'm looking around like, is it that I dropped something? Is there somebody behind me? I'm playing it. They're laughing some more. And I waited for the laugh to fall just to the right place where I could talk without killing my own laugh. And I cocked my head like a dog and I said, what? The hat? And I just folded my arms and stared at them. They laughed for a minute. A minute on stage is a lifetime.
It's a long time, yeah.
For people to laugh. I let the laugh die. I told them how I had the hat on my head. I grabbed it by the bill to throw it away. Mm-hmm. As one, the audience said, no! I said, you like this? Yes. All right. Did my show with the hat on. Part of your contracts when you're working on a cruise ship as an entertainer is you have to be available to the people.
Yeah.
Come into the audience, shake babies, kiss hands, uh-huh. sign autographs, be whatever.
Meet and greet.
And I came out without the hat on. Where's the hat? Where's the hat? Where's the hat? Okay. I went backstage, picked the hat up off the floor, dusted it off, put it back on my head, and then walked the ship to all the different things. What I didn't know, because it was my first cruise, was that if they liked you, if you were good, they videotaped the show. That tells you how long ago this is, VHS. Oh, wow. They videotaped the show and showed it at 11:30 as the nighttime thing to the whole ship.
Wow. So
500 people, because that was the capacity of the audience, 500 people saw me do it live. But the other 1,000 people who couldn't fit in saw me from bed. Okay. The next day I left my cabin to go to brunch. I didn't get 10 feet. Where's the hat? Where's the hat? Oh, where's the hat? If it was a Bugs Bunny cartoon, a light bulb would have come up from my head. This is a thing. The audience loves it. The next cruise, I had 3 hats. The next cruise, I had 7 hats. I began to add sparkly vests. Carol Channing told me, darling, wear jewelry. You're a masculine man wearing sparkles. It'll work. Wear your diamonds. Kay Ballard told me, wear sparkly scarves and jewelry around your neck. It'll bring everybody up to your face. Peter mm-hmm. Marshall's wife, Laurie, said, wear sparkly shoes. So when you walk, they can see it. Everybody contributed. I now have an entire closet in my home filled with sequined everything. And it changed my career and pushed me up to becoming a lot more famous. And I don't like the word because it sounds so pretentious, but to become a star. And I'm very, very, very...
You're a star, Jeffrey. What are you going to do about it?
Well, I'm not going to do anything about it. I just feel like it's egotistical to call oneself that. I'm very grateful to all the help I've gotten from all these wonderful people. But I had to be open to it. I had to be open to getting the advice, not resenting people for giving me advice, mm-hmm. and listening. You know, is there truth in what they're telling me? And if there is, what should I do about it? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Advice from Lucille Ball, advice from Steve Allen, advice from Milton Berle, advice from Shelley Berman, advice from Jonathan Winters. Wonderful Sid Croft. We just lost advice from Sid Croft. The list of people takes up about 5 pages in my memoir, which I'm just about finished with now.
So let's ask you some more questions.
I'm sorry, I'm talking too much.
No. I just want to get more questions in. That's all. What we want to know is that you are involved in multimedia high-end stage tributes. You wrote the 100th celebration, and as a primary historian on the legacy for the First Lady of a Song, Miss Ella Fitzgerald, when are we going to see the definitive Ella Fitzgerald story written for Broadway in only a way that you can write it? I haven't seen that. When are we going to see that?
It's never going to happen on Broadway.
Where is it going to happen?
Let me tell you why not Broadway first. there is no one who can sing her canon. I've met all the jazz ladies. I love them all.
Samara Joy can sing.
She can, and she is a protege of the Ella Fitzgerald Foundation, but she's not Ella. Where it can and should work is either a film in the theaters, on a platform, on a network, on Netflix, on HBO, where they can use Ella's voice for the singing parts. Ella is the most recorded female voice outside of opera in history. There is plenty to choose from the time she's 16 years old to her last recording in 1989, which was released in 1990. That, you know, from 1935 till 1990, it's a lot of years. For every era of her, for every age of her, there are appropriate recordings. I don't know why they have not yet. I've had my book, I don't know how many times they've bought the rights to look at making a film out of it. And I get money, but the film is never made. If I were a multi-multi-millionaire and I was going to back this myself, I would hire Oprah Winfrey because she looks like Ella.
You think if she can sing, though?
No. She'd have to lip sync to Ella's voice.
Oh, they would have to do the Adam. But
she could portray Ella the woman.
Okay, got it.
And then we'd have to get a younger African-American woman to do the younger year. Maybe a couple of them. Like teenage
Samara Ella, could do that.
Yes. Teenaged Ella. Ella in her 20s and 30s. And then around 40, Oprah could take over and play Ella for the rest of her life. The story is dynamic. The story is the reality of Ella's life, you won't be able to take your eyes off the screen. It just has never happened yet. And I'm waiting for, because my insistence is I don't need to write the script as long as I have script approval. Okay. I can make sure that they're telling the truth.
The true story.
There is no reason to lie or fantasize or fabricate anything here. And the other thing I insist on is that the director be African American.
Because that's going to be top line right there. That's going to be bottom line. But I have a question.
I won't do it otherwise.
I like that. I like that you stand for that. I wanted to ask another question though.
Go ahead.
Now you let me know because I did some research and you guys, I love AI. I'm serious. I'm not going to play. I don't need it to have a soul. It's not human. If I want someone with a soul, I'll go find a human being. But what I do, what sometimes the information may be incorrect, but I read that you helped the Smithsonian Institute break down the excellence of Miss Fitzgerald's voice by explaining to them the different tones and all the things that she does in singing. Is that true or not?
It's you're making it sound bigger than it was, but it's true.
You did. So what happened? Because I had never heard of anyone doing that.
I believe, and again, please forgive if this sounds egotistical, there is no one alive on this planet who better understands her voice, how she used it, what influenced her to get there, because her voice changed. Ella was not like 15 years old, this is the voice. It grew. And in every era of Ella's time, her voice changed. It reached its apex around 1966. Ella began to become ill with diabetes. There were operations to save her eyes because she was losing her eyesight. And her age, her weight, the operations back when they used gas to put you out, affected her larynx. And the Ella voice you heard in 1973 was different from the voice you heard in 1968. And rather than just give up, she got more creative. She understood the limitations. She didn't pretend like they weren't there and just used her voice even more creatively. Some of her most interesting work is after that point. So people don't understand all of that? I do. So again, my book is the go-to and my explanations are the go-to. I'm very grateful for that.
Oh, wow. That's a great, because I was like, wow, I didn't know that they would have, I mean, I had never heard of someone having to explain the technical brilliance of someone's voice.
Her arrangements, her musical arrangements are in the Smithsonian.
They are?
Yes.
Who knew that?
I do.
Well, we know now.
Yes.
You know, and people need to know that. You know, that there are these things around, and it has nothing to do, as I tell the audience, my audience is diverse. Nothing to do if you're old, young, black, white, you know, jazz or not. If you're interested in history and you're interested in the history of music, TV, film, these are the kind of people you need to be talking to, because other people weren't around. They just don't know. They'd have to go find a quote from somebody or try to run them down and see if they're still alive. You know,
there is a thing happening in my life. It's been happening the last 10 years, but every few months more so. We're running out of people. What was Milton Berle really like? Who can you ask? Is it true he was extraordinarily well endowed? I saw it. Yes, I can tell you.
Who did you see?
Milton Berle.
And he was hung?
Largely.
Shut up.
Now, I didn't have sex with him. Don't get the wrong idea.
No.
I was taken to the Friars Club by Jack Carter, another wonderful legendary comedian, to have lunch with Milton. And I could, you know, pat myself on the back how much I impressed him. What Milton liked about me is I knew show business history. I knew what I was talking about. He loved that. And he said, young man, I got to go to the bathroom. Come with me.
Oh. No.
So it was a thing with Milton. If he liked you, if you were now accepted as part of his clique, zip, plop. Just, okay, now you've seen it. Now you know. Let's go back to lunch. There's nothing naughty about any of that. Milton was a wonderful teacher. If you took the time to listen. Mm-hmm. How I am on stage, how I am on shows like this with people who aren't as good as you are. What to do? What to do if the questions are stupid? What to do if you're on a local television show and they're idiots? What to do if
they don't call
you? Because sometimes, you know, they'll try to gotcha you with a question that is, you know, it's a bad question. It's inappropriate. Well, what do you do? What do you do when you have a bad audience? What do you do when you get heckled? Milton taught me a lot of that stuff. How to write a great book, Steve Allen. Mm. How to be witty, how to bring things forward quickly out of my mouth, Steve Allen. Because wow. I was willing to learn. And now I'm mentoring other people because I'm passing it forward. Because the people who have helped me are, for the most part, unfortunately, already gone. But luckily, I have wonderful people like Rudy Lee and George Takiris who are in their 90s and still with us and still moving and going. And I get to enjoy their company even more now. But
well, I want to be like a little cricket in your pocket that goes chirp, chirp whenever you go into so I can hear chirp. Let me know so I can pass on. And believe it or not, there are plenty of young people out here that want to hear things, they just don't know anyone to talk to. Everyone is not hip or cool. Everyone is not approachable. Some of the old people have stank attitudes. You know, they don't want to tell anybody anything because they're jealous of the. I am not jealous of anyone. The only person I'm jealous of is myself and a version of myself that I'm still trying to get to. But we are close to time of ending. And I have one more important question for you, Jeffrey. When you are on stage and you were talking about your costuming and sequins and everything, is it more difficult to dress gay men in a production and film? Does it matter, or is it something they have to be sensitive to? What happens? I wanted to ask that.
If you're talking about as an actor, you have a costume, or her costumes you for the character. It's got nothing to do with whether you're gay or not. You wear what's given to you. You don't choose your wardrobe in a film or a show. A man or a woman designs it, and it's made, and you wear it. It's fitted to your body, so it looks good on you. If you're talking about a singer or a comedian who's choosing their own look, I was a little concerned at how over the top what I wear is when I first started wearing it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I don't take out my garbage now without some sequins on.
Okay.
And all these years, decades of this, everywhere I go, people thank me. You're sunlight, you're sunshine, you sparkle, you've made my... I was having a bad day till I ran into you. Now I feel so much better. I don't think I've ever been harassed for what I wear. I'm thanked. Every time I leave the house, I am thanked by people.
Wow.
For what I think for what I'm wearing, and also maybe
for being who you are.
For being me. For being me. A younger person said to me just this week, thank you. Thank you, because you're being you. I'm feeling more comfortable to be me.
Be me.
Which makes me very, very happy. And
so where can we find out about the more of the who about you, who you are, this version?
Well,
where can we
first of all, let me do a fast commercial for things that do not compete with you. Every week on 39 platforms around the world, Jeffrey Mark plays Ella, GPE. I play Ella's music on a theme, like okay. Ella and Count Basie. Play the songs, listen to them with you on video, and then tell you all the insider stories about how the music was made, and wow. who the musicians were, and what was happening mm-hmm. in Ella's life, and why those songs were chosen, or why that arranger is there. So that's every week on platforms all around the world. We have well over 2 million people now following us on this every week. It's wow. amazing. I'm going to be starting 2 new podcasts. I won't talk about them yet, but they won't be happening until June.
Okay.
And then there is a show that might be considered a little bit of competition with you. It's again, on these very same platforms and networks. It's called Still Talking With, and myself and my friends, Ben Bartlett and Jeff Holman, interview some of the most fascinating people in the world. That's live every Wednesday.
You haven't interviewed me, and I'm fascinating.
We are booked into August, my love. We'll get to you, so, I promise.
I'm in after August.
We are that far ahead now, and people wanting to be on the show, because we have 2.7 million reach now.
That's great.
It is.
That's great, Jeffrey.
And we're live, so that anything can
like
happen.
Like us, yeah, live.
We don't edit anything.
Yeah.
4 o'clock Pacific time, 7 p.m. Eastern time, wherever you are in the world, adjust your time. Mm-hmm. And it's on YouTube, and I'm on Facebook as Jeffrey Mark, just as it is right there. Find mm-hmm. me there. All my shows, the links will be there on my Facebook page. It's Jeffrey Mark Showbiz on Instagram. And I answer every message myself. So reach out to me.
Well, let's thank our wonderful Emmy award-winning, Grammy-nominated, hell of a writer, hell of a performer. I love Jeffrey. I love the sequins. I love anything different and out of the box. That's just me. And like I was saying last week, I wouldn't be around if it had not been for the LGBTQIA+ community. They didn't mind that I wasn't a member. They made me an honorary member because I was so out of the box and nobody... You know, they saw the value in me when no one else from other parts of the community saw me. So I thank them profusely for that and for keeping me around long enough to say this to an audience. Let's not forget to thank Sam Hassan, LA Talk Radio.
Yes, I've known Sam for years and years.
For allowing us to come on and do our shine every week.
Wonderful, man.
Social media tags. I am Osiris_Munir_the painter. That's my work behind us. I'm also a calligraphist, just so you know, I did that on my own. And then also listen up, without your support, your love and your caring, I would not be here. I love you. I love you for who you are. So I want you to like, That's wonderful. I want you to share, and I want you to subscribe.
Yes,
to the subscribe. Channel. Subscribe to the channel.
Subscribe to LA Talk Radio and do it now.
LA Talk Radio, so we can keep live radio alive. And so, like I said, I love you. I love you for who you are, for who you want to become, and everything about you. And I love you for being yourself and for standing up for yourself and not being afraid to be outside of the box and do good things. And don't forget to smile. It works wonders. Do you want to say something before we go? You got 2 seconds.
God bless and have a happy.
All right. Bye. Let's thank Jeffrey again, you guys. We love having him. We'll have him again soon. Okay. Bye-bye. Mwah-ah-ah.
You're listening to The Osiris Mounir Show, only on LA Talk Radio.